Today, I want to talk about the idea of helplessness. Helplessness has been showing up in conversation after conversation with people, both with clients and non-clients, and I'm seeing the presence of helplessness as a concept in so many different things and so many different activities, and activities that don't actually happen. So this is why I want to talk about it. It seems real clear that the sense or feelings of helplessness are stopping people from creating the lives that they want, to include, you know, if they're trying to create health or happiness or loving relationships or success. The idea of helplessness seems to be a big impediment. Now, it may be true with human nature that nobody wants to raise his or her hand and say to the world, I am helpless. And you could see that in situations in school classrooms where people won't ask for help of understanding that something the teacher is saying. It's like, if they don't understand, they don't want anybody to know, number one, they need help, number two, that not understanding may be an indication to them that something is wrong with them. They're dumb, they're less intelligent than their friends, those sorts of things. But if you look at about those people who are not willing to raise their hand, which is another way of saying they're not willing to reach out for the help they need, says to me the evidence of their feelings of helplessness shows up abundantly in their life because they are much more limited than they would be otherwise. I've spoken at length in both on Sundays as well as elsewhere about this idea of the journey from helplessness to happiness, or the helplessness to helpfulness. I think being helpful is going to produce a lot of happiness for us, so I think that's important to take into consideration. But in my model of that journey, I see six steps, or I'll call them six milestones. Number one, helplessness. Human babies are very helpful or helpless as a species. We require far more help than a lot of other species. And it's normal. And we think nothing of it that an infant requires help. The second phase is where people are being helped. Now, we would certainly hope that a baby crying from its crib because it's cold or hungry or afraid and it wants to be comforted would be helped. Somebody needs to go over to that crib, pick that child up, and care for it, nurture it, understand what its needs are, and then help it. The third step is being helped to help oneself. And you could see this starting to blossom in children really very young, 2 years old, maybe even younger, where they want to be helped to do it themselves. I want to do it. So this understanding of child trying to feed itself, even though it's going to be a really messy episode, is our natural movement up this scale. So a parent who says, you know what, I'm trying to help my child develop their sense of helpfulness and their happiness, and I'm going to coach them, I'm going to teach them, I'm going to walk them through these phases. So helping a child to help itself, how to tie shoes, how to do anything, how to feed itself, how to put socks on, all this kind of stuff is normal. And an impatient parent, of course, is going to sabotage that natural learning process. But a parent who understands this progression will certainly participate in that. Parents ultimately are the main teachers of children. So now we've moved to the fourth step, fourth phase, which is helping oneself. The child has now progressed to the point where they can do it themselves. They have been shown how to do it. They have been coached how to do it. They may have overcome having done it wrong several times, and now they can help themselves. They can take food out of the refrigerator. They can make their own sandwich. They can put their clothes on. They can choose clothes out of a dresser drawer and put them on. They can put their dirty clothes into a hamper. All of that stuff they have been helped to do, and now they can help themselves do that. In families with multiple children, what happens very often is the child, the older child who has now progressed through those four steps of helplessness, being helped to help themselves, and then helping themselves, will go on and start helping somebody else. They'll help a younger sibling. As a fifth out of seven children, I had a lot of older siblings who were very helpful to me. And you'd go, oh, I got natural inborn teachers here. The oldest sibling in the family only had two teachers, right? Mother and father within the family or under the same roof. But each subsequent child has one more child to teach them than others, one more child to help them than the others. So by the time it got to me, there were a whole bunch of people who knew how to help people. And I was, and have been, and still am blessed by the fact that my brother John, older by 2.5 years, has always been really helpful as a coach, as a mentor, as a helper, as a guide, as a sounding board. It's like, oh, yeah. So those kids help one another. Now, part of my regret is I accepted help, but I wasn't much of delivering help. I was more interested in escaping from my family environment. So my two younger siblings didn't receive the help from me that, in retrospect, I would have liked to have delivered to them. So I skipped over, say, that step five, helping another. I could have helped my sister Anne, I could have helped my brother George, but I took what I took and I got out of the house as much as I could. The ideal thing is to, after five, is to move to phase six, step six. The helpfulness in helping other people to help themselves. If we can get to that place of helping other people to help themselves, this is basically the teaching a person how to fish. And now they are going to start cycling through this. They're going to be in a position to be able to help other people. So understanding this will recognize, wow, I'm being helpful, helping somebody else help themselves. I'm not doing it for them. I'm helping them help themselves. And I feel happiness. I feel effectiveness. I think so. I think that's really where a great deal of our joy comes from, or happiness anyway, or pleasure, being effective at helping other people to help themselves. Because we're multiplied. If we just help another person, here's a fish. I'll be back tomorrow with another fish. Here's a fish. I'll be back tomorrow with another fish. Our ability to help is not magnified very greatly. However, when we help people to help themselves, now that person can start going out and they start multiplying. That's a mighty good thing. It occurs to me that if we understood those steps, those six steps, maybe there are more, maybe there are other variations of them that could be used, but if we accepted those as being normal in our lives, we're going to be happier. We're going to be less stressed, right? Instead of trying to hide my sense of helplessness or my unawareness, I'm going to deal with it and reach out for that awareness, reach out for that help, reach out for that support. And if we do that, we're going to be more successful. It occurs to me that we could almost examine any activity that we're participating in, or we want to participate in, but we're not doing it. Almost as if we were to examine from a procrastination standpoint, we could look at and determine exactly where we are in this journey. look at these six steps, almost like phases of a journey. Say, where are we? I know when Marianne and I travel in Florida from West Coast, where we live, to the East Coast, Miami or Fort Lauderdale, we used the mile markers on Alligator Alley, which is I-75 between those cities and Naples. And the mile markers are actually tells you how many miles you are in the journey. So we know that we get off on exit 107, or we get onto I-75 at 107, and then we drive toward the East Coast. And so we can tell where we are in this journey. We don't have to say, are we there yet? We look at the mile marker and we know where we are, relatively speaking. So if we were to look at something we want to do or we're not doing or something we did, and we're like, okay, why do we do it? From a helpfulness or a helplessness point of view, where were we in this process? I bet we could notice that some of our frustration is due to we're not there yet. And we go like, I'm not there yet, I'm not done. It's like, but why? Why? And so that self-criticism, that self-rejection, that self-disapproval, that frustration, that is basically another way of saying it's non-acceptance of the phase that we're in regarding that activity. You know, for us to be halfway in a journey in a car and be angry because we're only halfway there in a journey in our car, it's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. It means we're only halfway there. Why would a person be frustrated? It's not being halfway there that's the frustrating part. People will interpret other things. I was helpless at starting at the right time. Nobody helped me to start at the right time. I should have left hours earlier. Or it's, you know, being angry at the person ahead of you who is driving at a certain speed. It's like, doesn't he know I'm impatient? I need to get past him. Because why? Because I'm late. Why? Because I was helpless in leaving at the right time. Oh, so your lateness is not the guy's fault who is driving at a different speed on the highway. That lateness is really due to our helplessness at starting at the appropriate time for that particular journey. Oh, yeah, that's right. Good point. Let me take two examples. One of them is silly, really silly, right? I saw a 2-year-old child the other day. How about if I want that child to start writing its own biography? I want it to start using a pen and a piece of paper, writing an autobiography. If we insist upon that, guess what? We're going to be frustrated, and so is that child. But you say, wait, that child, regarding that activity, that child is helpless. A 2-year-old child being able to hold a pen and be able to write longhand on a piece of paper, I think that child's helpless in that regard. And probably will be for a number of years. I go, oh, yeah. And I'll help that child. Actually, our ability to help that child is going to be kind of limited as well. Because that child's physical development, their mental focus, is only going to allow a certain amount of help. That child is not going to go, oh, great, thanks. Take my hand, move it, let me tell you the words to write. No. Because those children, even young children, even though they can learn at amazing rates and do amazing things, but controlling a pen and a paper and having a vocabulary necessary to describe their life to date, I don't think so. That is going to be outside of their capabilities. So they need a lot more help, but the timing of it is inappropriate. We're going to have to wait on that activity. You go, oh, that seems incredibly obvious. Well, sometimes we do the same thing to ourselves. We're as demanding to ourselves as that example of being demanding of a 2-year-old child. I should know what I don't know. How is that possible? Well, in retrospect, I should have learned... Yeah, well, it's easy on Monday to decide on what you needed to know on Sunday. But that's not really a workable approach to things, because it ends up in so much regret and fault-finding and self-blame. Here's the second example. This is common, and it's important to many people. Having more money. I want to have more money. Very few people, even billionaires apparently, want to have more money. So this is important, but I think it's also very confusing to people. And because it's an ongoing struggle, it must be very difficult. If your work is a job that has hourly pay, the way to increase your money, to have more money, is to work more hours. Now, you could go to the boss and say, you know, you pay me X per hour. I would like you to pay me X plus Y per hour. And in that way, working the same number of hours, you'll end up with more money. But commonly, people end up working more hours. The trouble is, in a lot of scenarios, people become salaried employees. So working more hours isn't going to produce the pay. Oh, I worked 40 hours, I got X. I worked 50 hours and I got, oh, I got X. I worked 60 hours and I got, oh, X. Exactly. Now, it may not result in direct pay, but maybe it positions a person for promotions or for bonuses or both. This being salaried and working extra hours is like, well, it's coming. It's coming. It's not arriving in this Friday's paycheck, but in the future it will. Good. Good. In America, over the last, I think this has been going on for quite a few years now, the shocking experiences of helplessness that have resulted from blindly relying on the benevolence of corporate decision makers, a lot of people have now awake and going, you know what? You know what? Getting a job at, when I come out of college, working in this job for 30 or 40 years, and having a nice retirement, not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Because so many people got called in. Have a seat. I just want to let you know that the corporation is struggling, and we need to do some reorganizing. And as painful as it is for me to tell you, it's going to be more painful for you to hear it. We've eliminated your job. It's like, or we're closing the plant and moving it to China. Or because we've mismanaged it so badly, we're closing the business down. So you're out of a job. Those kind of things have led a lot of people to go, you know what? You know what? I better figure out a way to earn a living that doesn't involve my corporation. I've got to take a hobby and see if I can turn it into a money-making deal. I've got to start a business on my own. Maybe I don't love it, but if it'll produce revenue, that's really what I want to do. With all the hype surrounding internet marketing, surrounding franchises, you can start your own business. You can. All you need is to buy this package, and you can, you know, get funding from the Small Business Administration for your franchise or for your business. A lot of that stuff is hype. Now, it's easy to buy products, internet marketing products, but implementing them is not so easy. And it would occur to me that this may be the perfect place to apply the ideas of this journey from helplessness to helpfulness and happiness. You go, yeah. So why am I not doing certain things? And I think if we use that framework almost as a filtering system, why am I not doing this? Don't know how? can't ask for help, etc., etc. So there are many ways to become mindful about ourselves, about the objects of our attention, about our feelings with regard to those objects of attention, that is, how we bond with them or how we reject them, how we hold ourselves back or how we move ourselves forward to engage. If you want to do something in business, let's just take internet marketing, because that's one of the most meaningful, if you can do it, approaches to generating money, simply because it requires a lot less money than buying a franchise or buying a building and buying a store and buying inventory and having employees and so on. But we could look at that activity that's going to produce revenue. We could call it the business, or we could break it down and look at that specific activity, and we could determine our emotional states regarding that activity. You know, are we in shame or apathy or grief or fear or lust or anger or pride or courageousness or acceptance or peace? We could look at it and go, oh, we definitely want to move up. We want to move up to somewhere into the courageousness, enthusiastic, engaging level of the emotions, because we can attract more support, attract more help, and attract the information and awareness that we need for ourselves. We could also look at our four driving needs. Why, in our activity of dealing with this business, online business, what's active with regarding to the four driving needs? Are we trying to defend ourselves from criticism, emotional or physical attack, more than anything? It's like, then we're going to be like a turtle with its head in the shell. We're going to be withdrawn. We're going to be holding ourselves back. But if we turn around and go, no, I'm in the driving need number two. I want to come in first in the race of life. I'm really putting my energy out there. That's a better place. I'm trying to take all that's best for myself. That's not that helpful to customers. Taking from customers, it's like, oop, you might be subverting your own business, because that's going to be palpable to all but the dumbest, least aware customers. You show up with money in your eye, it's like, customers are going to back off. And then, if we're in the driving need number four, which is to hold on to everything, hold on to our possessions, hold on to this, hold on to that, we're not going to be very giving. We're not going to be very exchanging. And one of the keys to a successful business is the willingness to exchange. It's like, oh, yeah. I'll give you X, you give me Y in the form of money. Ah, you give me help, I'll give you money. Oh, that's what an employee would like to hear. You do this for me and I'll do this for you. Oh, yeah. So we've got to be willing to exchange. And those ego needs, pretty much all about the individual and not about the other people that we're dealing with. There's no real balance of self-interest. So if we've got that going on, we've got to figure out that is a hindrance to our success in business. And we're going to want to heal those drives. If we wanted to, we could actually look at the other needs that I find to be a common and convenient way to look at them. Survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, and the need to look good, get approval. If that need to be right, perfectionism, that need to be right is overriding everything else, we're not going to be able to take any risks. We're not going to be able to take chances. We're not going to be able to do things very easily that we haven't done many times before. Like, if you need to be right, it's very difficult to be an explorer or a developer or an inventor or a creator, because it's risky. I never did this before. Let me try it. That's really what we would need to do. And if we can get into that place, that's a whole different experience. And, of course, if we could evaluate where we are in the journey from helplessness to happiness and see which of those six steps are really what's most active with regard to this particular business activity that we want to engage in. That if we do engage in, it's going to have a high likelihood of producing money for us. And then, guess what? We're going to produce money for us right after we produce improved convenience and benefit and value for clients. So as we're helpful to them, we're going to be helped by their reciprocation because of our expectation of the exchange of energies. I'll help you do this, you pay me. Cool, cool. Looking at all of this, it seems that our sense of effectiveness is what produces feelings of happiness and satisfaction. So if we could help a small child grow in effectiveness right from the very first time, and whether that's walking or talking or toilet training or putting their shoes on or feeding themselves or doing any number of things, if we can help them get a sense of, you know what, I can become effective. Now, we don't start as effective people because we're helpless. But every new project that we engage in, if we have this underlying foundational belief that says, I can become effective, we're pretty much going to be willing to tackle anything. We're going to be willing to take on jobs and learn things that are more complicated than the average person who doesn't have that underlying belief. Going to go, oh no, it's too complicated. I can't do it. And they shy away from it. If we can help a child to develop that foundational belief, I can become effective. Or maybe the phrase is, I can become more effective, which is a good way to look at it, as compared to it being binary, ineffective, effective, no such thing. It's more effective. That scale of effectiveness that I talk about all the time, 0 to 100, with 50 at the midpoint, we're going to be somewhere in the range of 35 to 75% effective, and we slide up and down all the time, depending on what we're doing, thinking, feeling, and speaking. And it's like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If we can do that for children, we're faced now with being the parent to the child, and we are both of those. We're the parent encouraging us, the, I'm not sure I can do it, that kind of inner child voice of insecurity, to become effective. And we can ask for and receive help from other people. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. I read an article within the last year written by somebody who wanted to identify, and he came up with this framework, to identify a dog's intelligence. And it basically boiled down to this: how well the dog can get people to meet their needs of protection, of food, of care, of nurturing, of exercise, if that's a necessary element. All of those things are indicative of the intelligence of a dog. And you would go, wow, wow. Wouldn't we say, you know, maybe that's true for children as well? Of course, the parents ought to be committed to, hey, I'm going to display my intelligence by being helpful to you. And then you'll be intelligent by accessing and accepting the reality of helpfulness that comes from other people and from life in general. I think my view of the journey from helplessness to happiness with those six phases, I think it's valid, but it doesn't really take into consideration one hugely important fact. We have to be willing and able to reach out for help. The challenge over the years with children neglected in orphanages been labeled as failure to thrive. The problem with that is it just puts a label on it without dealing with any kind of cause. Causation, in that scenario, in my mind, is help was not delivered in a suitable fashion. Sure, the kids got food, but they didn't get touch. They didn't get spoken to. They didn't get cuddled. They didn't get nurturing and affection. And they learned help is not coming. Help is not coming. So they succumbed. They died. They gave up. What little life force must have made some sort of determination. What I need is not going to come to me, not available. And there was not enough life force to sustain their physical bodies. And they called that failure to thrive and ultimately death, childhood death. We could say that giving and receiving help, they're normal functions in normal environments. Normal functions in normal environments. But not everybody has been raised in a normal environment. The word dysfunctional families is that's almost redundant. If it's a family, it's dysfunctional. It's just a question of degree in most cases. And if a crying baby doesn't get comforted, it will tend, at first, that baby is going to get angry. Okay, I'm crying at this, that's not working. Now I'm really pissed off, and it starts really howling. And that's how we behave as adults as well. We go into rage at feelings of helplessness. And if that baby doesn't get comforted, even though it's cranked up, it's screaming to a level, it can learn that comfort is not coming my way. It is not going to be provided to me. The trouble with that, of course, it could learn that its needs are not going to be met. It's one thing if it's today at 3:15 p.m. when I was crying, my needs were not met. That'd be great. That'd be great. That's not what's happening. That belief can be generalized. It can be globalized to be, my needs will never be met. And that's a very big problem. You get children who are walking around as adults with the underlying belief that their needs will never get met. And every once in a while a need pops up, and because they're helpless to get it met, they go into anger. And you see a lot of violence out there, or you see them succumbing to it. So they're pinging back and forth. Violent anger, succumbing, depression, giving up. That is a big problem for an individual, for a family, and, of course, for society. We pack our prisons full of those people. So you can look around now in what we would consider to be even people who, I think they're an average person, they're a normal person, they seem to be functioning okay. But if their needs for help and comfort were never met as children, they would have learned that reaching out for help and comfort and support in present time is useless. They won't do it. They won't do it. And so what we have now is a being walking around with a hopeless, helpless, hapless state of mind. That's not very creative. Some environments are just not missing comfort and nurturing. Some are violently enmeshed. So a child who says, I have a need, and if that expressing of any need resulted in a violent backlash, somebody screaming at you, money doesn't grow on trees, there are people starving elsewhere on the planet, and or physical violence, I pretty much am going to avoid directly expressing my needs. Actions that have painful consequences, just like in the baby, same as in adults, we're basically going to fight them with anger. But if we're dominated by them, then we're going to go into avoidance. Avoiding altogether will be our choice. And you look at procrastination, you look at us holding ourselves back from an activity that's going to produce that more money, more happiness, more health, more success, more fun, more love, and you go, what frame of reference am I using for this? We're using childhood frames of reference. In America, there's the myth of the rugged individual, the self-made man. There is no such thing. Every successful person had lots of help to be successful, usually by other people, and a lot of people who had previously been helped to be successful by other people. You know, we talk about abuse. An abuser has been previously abused by somebody who was previously abused, by somebody who was previously abused. They pass on that contagion. So from a helpfulness standpoint, it's we wouldn't call it a contagion. We would really call it a trait that is wonderful to pass on. Is I've been helped, so I want to pay it forward. I want to help you. I want to help you. I want to help you. And so everybody in this whole line of helpfulness is getting the benefits and the happiness and the joy that comes from that. It's like, oh yeah, this is how it worked. You find somebody, and Anthony Robbins, he's a great force in America's self-help industry. He's preached this for years. If you want to be a success, find somebody who is successful doing what you want to do, figure out what they do, and emulate them. There's no mystery. You're not inventing the wheel. It already exists in a lot of different formats. All you have to do is identify it and emulate it. So we can use other people's examples as help for ourselves. What did it so-and-so? And his biographies are great for that. What did so-and-so do that? What Thomas Jefferson, what persistence and other people, all kind of creativity and imagination and on and on. We can get the principles that they used to help themselves and ultimately to help other people. Asking for help sounds like it should be easy. We can do it as little teeny babies, right? Wah, wah, wah. We do it naturally. But it isn't necessarily easy for us as adults. When we have those experiences of insufficient or non-existent help, we may conclude and then project that belief into the future. Oh, well, I didn't get help when I was 5, and here I am 55 or 45 or 25 or 95. That means I'm not going to get it now. No. The fact is, if you didn't get it at 5, you didn't get it at 5. Doesn't mean anything. If you can learn from that experience, that'd be great. But it doesn't mean it's going to recur every year for the rest of your life. We need to be able to look at that. Just because I had that insufficient help or non-existent help means those people were not aware enough, or I didn't express it well enough for unaware people to get it. And like, okay, yeah. In America, here's another stereotype. I don't know if this is true in countries outside of the U.S., we've got the stereotype of a man who refuses to ask for directions when he's driving a car. I've been in that case. I'd rather drive around for 4 hours lost than take 30 seconds to ask directions. But not anymore. Thank God for GPS, right? And wives as navigators, or iPhone maps, or any number of things. But why refuse to seek help when we're trying to navigate? And if we sought that help, if we asked for those directions, it's going to make our travels easier, it's going to make our life easier, it's going to make our use of time more efficient, it's going to be more fun, there's going to be less frustration, less stress. But why would we refuse to seek help? What potential loss of energy in some form, whatever form of energy that can be, that would justify not asking for energy, some guy standing there with directions at a gas station. If I ask for that energy, what, I'm going to lose energy. How? How? Well, I don't want to let anybody know I don't know everything. Okay. Gee, you'll be the first person on planet Earth not to know everything. So, for whatever, don't let on that you don't know everything. Isn't that crazy? That we don't know something, like directions, how to get from point A to point B, or we don't know how to do something? That occurs all the time. Unless your life is so small, unless your life is so narrow, you've been doing the same four things for 50 years. Let's do a fifth thing. Oh, no. Too scary. Not doing it. Nope. In my energy model of life, the first two phases are energy acquisition and energy preservation. In other words, we try to get energy. It keeps us alive, right? Little babies need this nurse. Don't do that. We're in big trouble. And when we get stuff, even little children do this, hold on to toys, hold on to the possessions that we have. We will protect those things. Those impulses are common to living things. You don't have to be a human being to have that tendency. You see animals behave that way as well. I know people, and I have this tendency myself, who can only accept help if they can pay for it. For us, accepting help without paying for it seems to create some form of psychic debt, which is, I'm going to lose something because now I have debt. That somehow it weighs on us and it creates an imbalance that is really unpleasant. No, I don't want to owe anybody anything. I don't want to owe anybody anything. And consequently, help without pay has to be avoided. Nope, not doing it. It's oddly funny, though, that those people and myself, we can provide help without compensation, but we can't receive it without paying for it. What's up with that? Maybe it's a trust issue. Maybe it's a deserving issue. Maybe it puts us into, quotes, an inferior position. If I have to accept help from somebody, that means I'm inferior. No. Actually, if you accept help from somebody, you're giving them a gift and you're giving yourself a gift. Oh, I missed that class. I missed that lesson. Yeah, most of us have. And, of course, on the other side of the spectrum, there are people who have perfected the extraction of help from other people through manipulation or charm or playing the victim card. Oh, I can't do this. Could you help me? And that sort of thing. And the trouble with that for them is they reinforce their own sense of helplessness. But because they're skillful at manipulating other people, they don't really experience painful consequences in the short term. So they're using people as crutches and as tools that they don't really need to do. And they don't develop the sense of effectiveness other than pretty damn effective at manipulating other people. And these people seem also to have a highly developed willingness and ability, besides extracting energy from other people, getting other people to do it for them, they have skills and a cleverness at preserving the energy that they've acquired. Them, and maybe most people, myself included, have some skill at manipulating help from people. But after we overdo this, guilt can result. And guilt and its partner, regret, can keep us asking for help. I didn't feel good. You know, I've got to figure out some way to balance this. I can ask for help where it doesn't produce guilt, doesn't produce regret, doesn't produce loss of status or loss of energy or loss of self-image. We can heal that. But when it really comes down to it, I like Christ's views as he describes in Christ Returns Reveal Startling Truth about reaching out to divine consciousness and asking for enlightenment. That seems, just think of it, no risk there. It's the easiest, it's the safest, it's the most accessible, and I'm thinking it's actually the most practical help we have available to us. Christ goes on to say that if we ask and believe, right? It's one thing to ask and go, it's never going to happen. Ask and believe, it will come to us. To net that out, that means going to the source of all help, and those are capital letters, capital S, capital A, capital H. Going to the source of all help is the best action we can possibly take. And the awareness that we get gifted as a result of that will then provide the best next action to us. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 in Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. Listen for the amount of help that is promised in this prayer. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.